I trust that everyone has had an opportunity to dry out from the rainstorm here, and so we would like to go ahead and begin. It's my pleasure to open this afternoon's session by introducing James Faulkner. James, commonly known to his friends as Jim, and I have a few other nicknames for him too, which he's made me promise I will not repeat in this session, is a graduate of Brigham Young University. He started there in mathematics, but quickly saw the error of his ways and switched to English at the end of his freshman year, if memory serves me correctly. He subsequently got his master's degree and PhD in philosophy from Pennsylvania State University. His particular areas of interest are Hegel and contemporary European philosophy, and he teaches, of course, philosophy presently at Brigham Young University, where he also serves in the bishopric of Brigham Young University 30th Ward. The topics that he will be discussing with us today are taken in part from a book that is in the process of being written on the nature of community. I asked him what he would like me to tell you about him, and he was insistent, of course, that I tell you about his beautiful wife, and it is true, Jan is beautiful, and his four terrific children, and that is also true, even though they did wake me up at 2 o'clock this morning. After we hear from Jim, we will have a response from Albert Peck, who, as many of you know, is another BYU graduate and is also the editor and founder of 7th Street Press, sorry, 7th East Press. I'm from Phoenix, you know, and the geography here gets confusing occasionally, and is presently managing editor of Sunstone.
I really like this podium. It's one of the few times I actually get to look down at anyone. If they could think of a way to make me artificially thinner, that would also help. Thanks. There. Most people would have little difficulty relating an individual to the broader human context in which he or she lives. It would seem at first glance to be obviously true that there are both individuals and groups of individuals, and that we are each, in some sense, both distinct from every group of which we might be a member, and at the same time a part of and defined by those groups. But in attempting to bring this fact to understanding, in attempting to explicate the relation between individuals and groups of individuals, thought seems to be drawn to unacceptable extremes. One of the extremes makes the notion of individuality primary, while the other sees the primary reality to be the whole, the group. A great deal of Western thought has adopted the second alternative, as have also others. According to this alternative, which I call collectivity, the individual human being is definable only in terms of the whole of humanity, or the whole of the state, or the church, or some other group. In philosophy, this notion is well represented in the work of the early 19th century Hegelians. And I say Hegelians for a reason. I frankly do not think this is Hegel's notion, but his followers subscribe to what I would call collectivity. For them, the individual is merely a part of an overall activity. The particularity of the individual is merely a function of this temporal expression of the absolute. Thus, the individual is merely the smallest piece of the absolute, that which can be divided no further, the individuum, the undividable. Therefore, as a part of the absolute, individual conduct should be that which fits within the overall activity of the absolute. And since the larger group, the church or state, for example, is a larger piece of this absolute, a larger expression of its activity, the actions of the individual should be such as to bring about the function of the larger group, which in turn must bring about the further expression of the absolute. By substituting various things for the absolute, we get variations of collectivity. By substituting the traditional God, who is one and indivisible, but arguably not an individual, we get a traditional Christian version. Substituting dialectical materialism gives us one or another variation of Marxism. By substituting the good of all, we get utilitarianism or some such. But all of these are variations of collectivity. All define the individual by her function in the whole. Several critiques of collectivity have been made. The one that comes immediately to mind is that of Kierkegaard, but Nietzsche has made a critique of it in his attack on herd morality, and Heidegger's analysis of Das Mann, the they, provides still more criticism of it. In one way or another, they each point out that such a position is an alienating position. The collectivist individual strives to incorporate the larger whole, the universal, into himself, not merely in the abstract, but in his very becoming. He attempts to realize that larger whole, in Hegelian terms the absolute, in himself. But being a particular person, he cannot be the universal he strives to be. He simply cannot ever be all of the necessary manifestations of the larger whole without ceasing to be the particular person which he in fact is. Thus, in striving to be what he is not and cannot be, The collectivist individual is necessarily alienated, both from himself because he's trying to be what he is not, and from the larger whole because the more he strives to become its realization, the more apparent it becomes that he cannot be. As Kierkegaard points out in the concluding unscientific postscript, a collectivist system contradicts itself. The state or society or church or whatever group it is that defines the individual in question demands that the individual be responsible for herself as an individual, and it demands at the same time that she act as part of an overall activity rather than as an individual. In other words, collectivity demands both that the individual assert herself in her particularity and that she subsume herself under the universal of the collective. But to subsume herself under the universal is not to assert herself. Though it has its roots in the subjectivism of Cartesian metaphysics, the alternative to the collectivist view first appears as a philosophical alternative in the 19th century. Those who take this alternative insist that the primary term in the relation between the individual and the larger whole is the individual. In the interpretation of the work of Kierkegaard, we find a formulation of this view which has had a major impact on contemporary thought. And as I do in the case of Hegel, I would distinguish between those who interpret Kierkegaard and the thought of Kierkegaard himself. For Kierkegaardians, the individual is not only individuum, the smallest unit in an overarching activity, it is also the single one. The single one has a relation to the absolute, to God, but it is more than merely a function of the absolute. In the absolute, the Hegelian individual lost his identity and was significant only as he fit into it. As long as he or she fulfilled the functions needed for the activity of the absolute, any particular individual could be substituted for another in the Hegelian scheme of things. Likewise, in any collectivist system, as long as the function which allows the collective to continue its activity is performed, the identity of the individual performing the function is insignificant. However, the Kierkegaardian individual maintains his identity in the face of the absolute. In fact, it seems that it's precisely because he maintains his identity that he is able to be in relation to the absolute. We might argue that the individual is primary in the following way. Every relation must have at least two terms. Therefore, for there to be any relation at all, of the individual to the larger whole, the identity of the individual cannot disappear within the larger whole as it does in collectivity. Thus, not only must the individual maintain his identity and stand out in the relation of individual to group, because there are no groups which are not groups of individuals, because there is no absolute, unless the particular activities which make it up occur, the individual is of primary importance in this relation. But this view, too, is alienating. In section A of chapter 4 of The Phenomenology of Spirit, Hegel argues that human consciousness is a product of recognition by another who has human consciousness. In other words, human consciousness cannot occur in isolation. It exists only among human beings, relationally. I cannot know who I am, he argues, if I do not exist with other humans who recognize my humanity. I find his claim convincing. But if we are the kind of individuals posed by individuality, individuals defined wholly by their own unique identity, and not by the larger human context in which they occur, such recognition is impossible. The individual needs others as occasions for consciousness. But consciousness is always of, or to, or for, and so on. And the mere individual can have no more than the appearance of others to his consciousness, because he cannot get outside his own individuality. Thus, his consciousness is always of, or to, or for, an appearance, a manifestation of himself rather than another individual, if he has human consciousness at all. Suppose, for example, that the consciousness of which we are speaking is the love of another. In this model of consciousness, my love is not love for my wife, it is love for the appearance of my wife. But an appearance is not the occasion for proper love. So by this model, love is impossible, as is any other human relation. In fact, the only kind of love possible for this kind of consciousness would be that of the romantic, the person in love with love and not with another, the person for whom the other in a love relationship is only the excuse for the gushing forth of the self-created and only self-fulfilling sentiment. Since the individualistic individual is a mere individual and not already in relation to others, nothing in her individuality can give her the ground upon which to establish the relation to others. Her relations are only to herself if there are any relations at all. But without those relations to others, existence as a human being is impossible. From the standpoint of individuality, it seems that the individual is either isolated, acosmic and solipsistic, or not an individual at all. For there is nothing in mere individuality which will allow for the creation of relation. Thus, individuality brings us to an alienation similar to that which collectivity brought us to. The individual is alienated from both the larger group of which he is a part and from himself, the former because relation is impossible, and the latter because his genuine consciousness is impossible without relation. We are impaled then on the horns of a dilemma. We seem to be forced to choose between individuality and collectivity, but both end in alienation. We see both the choice between these two and the resulting alienation over and over again at the practical level. On the one hand, it seems impossible to avoid choosing one of these over the other. On the other hand, whichever one we choose, our conscience gnaws at us for not choosing the other. What, for example, do we do when our bishop takes a course we think unwise? If we go along, we feel badly that we are doing what we think to be wrong. But if we don't go along, we feel badly that we have rebelled, that the order of the church has been disrupted. Some will say that the answer is just to go along, that we will not be accountable for following the lead of a mistaken bishop. But that slickly glosses over the problem, which is not accountability. In such situations, we are rarely very concerned with whether we will be punished for our mistakes. We are often, indeed, genuinely concerned for the welfare of the church and its members. Explaining that I will not be accountable for following a mistaken leader will not help me feel better about what will happen as a result of his mistake. On the other hand, some will say we should stick to our convictions and refuse to go along in such situations. That in the end, the church will be better off for our acts than if we just go along. But I'm rarely so confident in my convictions that I would be willing to make myself the standard for the church. Even when I'm fairly confident that my leader is wrong, I am rarely so confident that I am right. In addition, I am not at all convinced that defiance or rebellion does what it supposedly is intended to do. My experience is that revolutions, whether large or small, very often ensconce the establishment even further in its mistake, especially in the kinds of settings we're discussing here, when a person takes a course of action in opposition to a church leader because she or he is convinced the leader is mistaken. The only solution to the dilemma is to find a way to pass between its horns, to find a third alternative. There is such a third alternative in religion. This alternative is one in which there are genuine individuals, not merely the indivisible points of collectivity, and at the same time there is relation among individuals. But as we shall see in this third alternative, neither the larger whole nor the individual is what it appeared to be from the point of view of the other two supposed alternatives. As we saw, radical individuals are unable to be recognized by others, and therefore they are also unable to recognize others. As a result, it is impossible for them to have relations to one another. This is because they are unique. They are absolutely other than one another, and so unaided, they are unable to find some ground from which to recognize one another. If they were not absolutely other than one another, that which they have in common would be a universal, a given human nature, and we would be back to the Hegelian kind of explanation at best, in other words, collectivity, and determinism at worst. In addition to being unique, it seems we must suppose that human individuals have what I would call infinite depth. There is something indeterminate about the individual at every point of her existence. Were this not the case, it would be possible to overcome the otherness of individuals. But that overcoming would be annihilation. If the other could be brought to a final determination, a point at which change or development was no longer possible, she would no longer be a person. For having nothing more which could be said of her, she would be dead. She would no longer move, because to move from A to B is to be indeterminate at A. She would no longer speak, because to speak is to say one thing rather than another, to be indeterminate. She would no longer think, because to think this rather than that is to be indeterminate. And doing none of these things, she would be profoundly dead, whatever her biological state. But a dead person is not another person at all. It is a thing, and a thing cannot either recognize or be recognized. Now, of course, we do speak of things as being recognized by us. We take, "I recognize that," when we point to something, to be synonymous with, "that is recognized by me." But though it makes some sense to speak of objects in this way, the passive has a different sense in reference to humans. By the phrase being recognized, I mean a way of being a person has or carries out as one recognized by another in relation. Thus, being recognized is an activity carried out by the person recognized, a way for the person to be, a person who is, excuse me, in other words, it is being humanly conscious. Such a determinate person, a person who is dead and as a consequence is no longer a real person, cannot be what is necessary to relation and human consciousness. In another relation, the other in a relation must have the infinite depth given by indeterminacy. Thus, the recognition which makes human consciousness possible is at least a recognition of the otherness and depth of both the self and the other. And that is one recognition, not two. Such a recognition must be initiated by one at least equal to the individual being recognized. As Hegel points out in his discussion of the dialectic of master and slave, recognition of the superior by the inferior cannot bring about human consciousness in the superior, and therefore it cannot bring about the relations necessary to genuine community. Kierkegaard, who rarely agrees with Hegel about anything, agrees on this point. In Sickness Unto Death, he says, "A herdsman who, if this were possible, is a self only in the side of cows is a very low self. and so also is a ruler who is a self in the sight of slaves. For in both cases, the scale or measure is lacking. The measure for the self is always that in the face of which it is a self. The individual must be recognized by another individual in order to have human consciousness, in order to recognize either himself or others. But this poses a logical problem. If Eve is to recognize Adam, he must first recognize her. But if Adam is to recognize Eve, she must first recognize him. Since neither individual can recognize the other without first being recognized by the other, and since such recognition is required for genuine relation, genuine community, such community is impossible for bare, unique individuals. What is necessary is a third individual, one who is already possessed of the kind of consciousness required, one who is like humans in being both other and indeterminate, one who is at least equal to those being recognized. What is needed, in other words, to explain the possibility of genuine community is God. He is unique. He is other and indeterminate. He is at least our equal, and he is a person. Here I think Latter-day Saint theology has an ace up its sleeve. For our God is not just metaphorically a person. Recognition by one who is only metaphorically a person ought to provide human consciousness only metaphorically. Whatever we have about us that makes us the individuals we are, we share with God by being in his image. The individual who has been recognized by the divine is aware of her otherness, and she is aware of the other who has recognized her. This is the ground for her relation to other people, for the possibility of her being in community with other persons. Seeing that she has been recognized by God and recognizing him in return, she can now recognize individuals in their otherness, and therefore also in their relation. And that recognition is constitutive of religious community. One cannot recognize others in their otherness and depth without implicitly recognizing God, since he is the ground for the possibility of such recognition. As Martin Buber has put it, God is the common center toward which all individuals turn, and which therefore constitutes them as community. The divine makes possible the transformation of the unity without relation found in mere individuality into the community, the being with, of genuine community. And though the recognition of others and the recognition of the divine is logically dual, in human action it is necessarily single. To do one, is to do the other. This view of individuals in community shows the community to be a mode of both individuality and relation. It shows these to be two facets of the same phenomenon, rather than opposing, paradox-producing ways one must somehow simultaneously tread. The relation of religious community, and that is a redundant phrase, since I believe all genuine community is religious and all genuine religion is communal, is well illustrated in dialogue. In speaking, I speak because I recognize the difference, the distance between myself and the other to whom I speak. Though I speak across this distance, I cannot eradicate it. For to do so would be to make the other over into myself and to make an end of speaking. The fact of the distance between us and the indeterminacy of each of us, as well as the common ground between us, on which we stand, makes dialogue, human relation, possible and necessary. Without any one of these elements, without distance, without indeterminacy, and without common ground, I cannot speak. Distance then turns out to be Heracleitean. For being brought apart, they are brought together with themselves. The fact that we are, in our otherness and indeterminacy, different from one another guarantees that no individual can ever sublate another and gives rise to the possibility of continued conversation. The fact that we must stand in the unity created by God's recognition of us and the resulting mutual recognition of each other guarantees that it is never impossible to speak. The ever-present possibility of conversation, of genuine human relation, binds individuals together in community in such a way that they are truly the individuals that they are in that binding. And this binding, as opposed to the mere bundling of collectivity, marks the difference between dialogue and either silence or chatter, between community on the one hand and solipsism or collectivity on the other. Such a relation as that exemplified in dialogue has its ground in God, for it is only through him that the recognition of self and others as individuals, and therefore separated, can occur. And only through him can the larger unity in which that separation occurs exists. Nietzsche's charge against Christianity is that it divides the world into two extremes, the finite world and the infinite heaven, each discontinuous from the other. Then it forces us to choose between the two. By setting things up in this way, he says, we must necessarily deny one or the other element of our being, and Christianity chooses infinity, pie in the sky, thereby rejecting finitude. In order to be saved, the Christianity he describes demands that we reject our humanity, that we become alienated from ourselves. Attempts to formulate human existence in terms of either individuality or collectivity, attempts which, like the Christianity he describes, deny the truth, are open to a similar charge. As an individual, the individual is finite, but the possibility of relation reveals the equally present possibility of infinity. The infinity of possibilities opened up by relation to others, the infinity of indeterminacy revealed in my relations, and the infinity of difference between any two individuals, which is the ground for all relation. Thus, any individual must be described in terms both of his finitude and his infinitude. But the way in which we usually talk about these matters attempts to reduce one to another, to collapse the finitude of the individual into the infinity of relation, as in collectivity, or the reverse, as in individuality. Human existence in community must maintain, simultaneously, the infinite, the finite, their difference, and their unity. We must be bound together in our individuality by our relation to God. The word religion itself points toward this necessity. The English word is derived from the Latin religionem, and Cicero claims it is related to the term religere, to read, though later in modern writers believe it to be from religare, to bind. It's possible that either Cicero or the modern writers is correct, for the word seems ultimately to be derived from two possible Indo-European roots, leg and leg, L-E-G and L-E-I-G. The first of these means to collect and has derivatives meaning to speak. Thus, though Cicero's etymology sounds implausible at first, it may well be the case that he was not far from the mark. These two etymologies may not be as distinct as it first seems to be the case. To read something during Cicero's time was to read out loud, and thus to speak. Religion is a speech, the divine speech, and as the Indo-European root suggests, speech is a collecting, a gathering. In speech, individuals are gathered, collected to one another. Thus, religion is the speech which gathers individuals to the divine and consequently also to each other. On the other hand, the other possible root, L-E-I-G, means to bind and justifies an alternative etymology. Given the similarity of the meanings of these two roots and their obviously close morphology, it is reasonable to suggest that they are either variations of the same term, perhaps the latter is the I-grade of the former, I-grade form of the former, or there is a third term standing as their common root. However, whether one accepts the hypothesis that these two etymologies are variations of the same thing, or insists that they are distinct, makes no difference. In either case, religion is a matter of creating community, of gathering and binding individuals to God and to each other. Consider as well the prefix of this word, re. This almost always means something like again, as in repeat. In what sense is the binding which takes place one which takes place again? In that one is always doing what has been done before. Here again, and in its explicit theme of binding and sealing, Latter-day Saint theology has another ace up its sleeve. Authentic human action always occurs within a context provided by those who have gone before the individual. Thus, there are two sides to the repetition inherent in community. First, community can only be where individuals have relation to one another. Dialogue between individuals is essential to the existence of community. It is synonymous with it, and such dialogue must be repeated again and again forever. Second, the individual exists in dialogue with the possibilities created by his origins, the context created by the community. And the community exists in continued dialogue with the further possibilities created by the individuals within it. The individual must dialogically repeat what is given by his origins in the community. The community must dialogically repeat what is given in the responses of the individuals within the community. Of at least equal importance in understanding the meaning of the prefix is understanding that it means more than merely again. If we consider the same prefix when it occurs in some other words, we see that it must mean more. The word resound and reside both contain it, but neither implies that something is to be done again. In fact, when we want to make the notion of again explicit in the first of these, resound, we change both the spelling and the pronunciation. We insert a hyphen between the prefix and sound, and we cease to give voice to the S so that we say resound. The prefix gives these words the notion of continuing presence. Thus, it more generally means continuation rather than simply repetition, since the latter is a more specific case of the former. Not only are individuals and community indeterminate, not only is it impossible to bring their existence to some final point, but the community itself is indeterminate. The dialogue of community is one which must be continued. The founding of community and the divine speech which constituted in the recognition of humans by God must be continued. It cannot be once and for all over and done. There is no community outside the activity of continually creating community, outside the task of continuing to act in relation to others and to God. Religion calls us to this task by not only its name, but by its and our nature as well. To be pierced by either horn of the dilemma of individuality versus collectivity is to deny ourselves, to deny others, and to deny God. It is to have to cease to be religious. No matter what outward trappings we might put on, it is to cease the dialogue of community. Thus, if I think the bishop is mistaken, my duty is not to either agree or disagree with him. The choices are put to us as if we can either rebel or submit, but those are not the only choices. I can also continue to live with him in our relation to God. I can discuss, understand, and explain. I can listen, critique, and advocate. But these are only the possible facets of a larger reality if I live with him in community. The larger reality is my recognition of his depth and otherness, and my respect for the difference between us which makes our relation possible. It is also a recognition of the mutual ground upon which we stand, our relation to God, a ground which makes it essential that we labor together for agreement. And I cannot tell in advance whether the agreement we reach will be because he comes around, or I come around, or, as is more likely, whether we both come around to another answer. The same problem emerges in many other areas of our lives. In any area where we feel there's a conflict between the demands made upon us as individuals and those made upon us as members of a larger whole. Though I have not done the analysis which would be necessary to come to a conclusion, I suspect the current argument between liberal and conservative economics is a case of being pierced by one or the other horn of this false dilemma. For the question in this argument is often, do we choose the common good, collectivity, or the individual good, individuality? And the paradoxes generated in this confrontation are analogous to those I have described in talking about individuality and collectivity. There is a similar problem in discussions about church history. Though it's not completely a question of individual integrity versus loyalty to the church, the battle lines are often drawn that way. But to see the battle that way, or even to accept those lines, is to have agreed to the false dichotomy between individuality and collectivity, between learning what is true through being an individual and learning what is true through the authority of the church. The truth about these matters is that there is a broader perspective, and from within that broader perspective, we must labor in our relations to each other and to God to say the truth. And when we do so, it will not be either what would be said by a mere individual looking at that history and its truth, nor would it be what would be decreed by some mere collectivity telling us what we should see as the truth. Instead, it would be the result of the labor of community, the constitution of community, and so would satisfy neither the collectivist nor the individualist. We see it also in less heated confrontations, in, for example, our discussions of doctrine. On the one hand, we say we are saved by the atonement of Christ through our obedience. On the other hand, we say no one can be saved alone. Salvation is a group affair. From the point of view of individuality, the latter of these makes no sense. But from the point of view of collectivity, it is obvious. It's the former which is nonsensical. From the point of view of community, however, the interpretations of these two claims, which are made by both the individualist and the collectivist, and which put them into conflict with one another, are both nonsensical. For since salvation is a community activity, it is obviously something which must be done by individuals working together and made possible by God. It is a labor which grace makes possible, and since it is a labor as opposed to merely a toil, it is something which must be done by individuals with and for each other. I would even go so far as to say that ultimately salvation is exactly the labor of community. It is the binding of individuals to each other in relation, a binding made possible by God's active recognition of human beings and brought about in our active, laboring recognition of each other. Salvation is the fruition of being an individual, and being an individual is only really possible in relation to other individuals. So salvation is community, and genuine community is salvation. And the denial of community by either the individualist or the collectivist is the denial of salvation, and therefore the denial of God.